The next case of the morning is number 023127. Cleveland against Household Bank. Mr. Nicholson.
Good morning. My name is Bob Nicholson. I represent three Chapter 7 trustees in approximately 98 consolidated cases, all involving the same issue, the proper treatment of the repayment within 90 days prior to their respective bankruptcy filings of what are called refund anticipation loans, all from Defendant Household Bank. The basic transaction was pretty simple. The parties would go in and have their tax refund, their tax return prepared electronically. In connection with that, they would get a refund. They would ask that their refund be deposited to a particular account at the bank. And in connection with that whole thing, the bank would give them a loan, less applicable fees, basically so that when the anticipated refund would come in, it would effectively pay off the loan. The documentation references a security interest in the various and sundry refunds, but pursuant to the stipulations of the parties, they never filed a financing statement, which is really what is necessary, at least in Indiana and in Delaware, which is the law under the various documents to perfect the security interest in an individual's tax refund.
Now, your opponents characterize this transaction as an assignment. And reading your briefs, it seemed to me that you never really squarely dealt with that argument. Why isn't this an assignment? And if isn't an assignment really the silver bullet here? Doesn't the assignment make this a legitimate transaction?
Well, I think you have to look at the documents itself. And when you look at the loan agreement, the loan agreement doesn't say that I'm assigning my tax refund. The loan agreement says I'm granting a security interest. That's what the truth in lending disclosure provides.
And isn't it somewhat commonplace for in a transaction like this to attempt to cover your bases in more ways than one?
Well, it is, but at the same time, you know, you have to take the document as it is. Language of an assignment is not inconsistent with
security.
Language of a security, whereas security interest language is inconsistent with a complete and absolute assignment. And I think if you look at the rest of the documentation that's associated with this transaction, and in particular the Internal Revenue Service form that provides for the direct deposit of the refund into the particular account, it references my refund. And I think if you look at the revenue procedure under which that is allowed, it specifically states that it has to go to the debtor's account for the benefit of the debtor. You know, I don't know how you can say that the bank has all of the rights in that refund and comply with both the terms of the revenue procedure as well as the IRS form itself.
If this is an assignment, do they prevail?
I would think that you would have to. I mean, if it's a contemporaneous transaction, and if the debtor has divested itself of any right into that refund in connection with the loan, then certainly the trustee's position is substantially weakened. I really believe that a review of the documents themselves, all of the documents, you know, the bank likes to look at the loan application, and that's where they find all the language about the assignment. But when you look at the actual loan agreement, that's where it talks about the security interest.
Well, they certainly go to, in this transaction, they certainly go through an awful lot of trouble, don't they, to the bank does, to make sure it's going to get it.
Well, and...
And nobody else.
As which sort of goes to one of the issues that the bankruptcy court addressed, and that is, you know, the ordinary course of business. You know, whether whether this transaction is in the ordinary course of a consumer debtor's business.
In other words, that really the bank here is in the position of helping people who are about to jump into a bankruptcy situation to save a little for themselves. That's the business they're in with respect to these kinds of loans. Is that your point?
Well, what's very interesting about it is that you have these situations where, you know, and these are very short term loans. I mean, these are like, you know, 10 to 12 days or whatever. And of course, with the fees and everything, it's very expensive financing. And you have to ask yourself, you know, does a consumer debtor ordinarily enter into transactions like this? You know, probably not. And then,
wouldn't you think that the great majority of people who do this are not contemplating bankruptcy?
That may well be. That may well be. But I don't believe that is the proper test for whether it's in the ordinary course of business for that particular debtor. And when
with Judge Ripple's question, if the bank had, say, advertised, if you're contemplating bankruptcy, come and see us with your tax return problem. We can help you. That's certainly a different situation than what you have here. We're in the ordinary course of business. They are making these kind of loans. They're just like payday loans, where you come in on a Wednesday and you're going to get paid on Friday, and you get your money in advance, less an exorbitant interest rate.
And the point that I'm trying to make is that yeah, this is in the ordinary course of the bank's business, no doubt about that. And that's what that was stipulated, you know, and that's what the bankruptcy court and the district court really focused upon in here. You know, they said, okay, well, it's in the ordinary, we stipulated it's in the ordinary course of the bank's business, and we stipulated, what's our other one? Sorry about them. Ordinary course of the bank, and that the transactions were in the ordinary course of the refund anticipation loan industry. You know, those two things. But what we're missing is what you might call the symmetry. Where are the stipulations or any discussion even of what is in the ordinary course of business? Not only, you know, on a global level for a consumer debtor as a whole, and in particular for these individual debtors. You know, one of the
I guess I'm mystified as to why that's necessary.
Well, I believe,
is that necessary, given the stipulation and given that it isn't done in anticipation of bankruptcy, or certainly you didn't present any evidence that it was done in anticipation of bankruptcy? Why is that additional information necessary for us to make a judgment whether it was really in the ordinary course?
Well, first of all, the burden of proof on the ordinary course defense is on the bank. And I believe that if you look at Seventh Circuit decisions and other...
Yeah, but then they got a stipulation on that, so they...
No. I don't believe they had a stipulation that this was in the ordinary course of the debtor's business. The stipulation is that it was in the ordinary course of the bank's business. But the flip side of that is, it has to be, if you read the statute, it says it's a debt that is incurred in the ordinary course of business of the debtor and the transferee, and it's a payment that is made in the ordinary course of business of the debtor and the transferee. And when you look at the stipulation and you look at the way both the bankruptcy and the district court resolved this case, they said, okay, since it is in the ordinary course of business of the bank, the only thing that we have to look at is whether this is ordinary in connection between the debtor and the bank. They never looked at whether it was ordinary in the context of the debtor and its other creditors. And I believe that is where the ordinary course defense here fails. There's no evidence about that. And that is, I believe, really required by the cases. We've got Milwaukee Cheese, Bologna Pizza. They both discuss that it has to be ordinary from both the debtor and the transferee's perspective.
If we were to agree with your colleagues on everything but that point, what would be the what would we have to do? Send it back on that point?
Whether
this is in the ordinary course of business from the debtor's perspective. If does this need to go back to the district court on that point?
Well, you know, I don't believe so because, you know, the parties agreed to submit it on stipulated facts.
Nobody stipulated those facts.
The case was fully submitted on stipulated facts. I mean, everybody, you know, you take the good with the bad. It's kind of like when you sit down to rest your case, and if you missed an element of your burden of proof, you missed an element of your burden of proof. And I believe that that's what happened here. I think I'll reserve my time.
Thank you, Mr. Nicholson. We'll hear now from Mr. Carpenter.
Charlie Carpenter for Household Bank. I'm joined by Linda Casey from my firm. I guess I'd like to start by answering Judge Ripple's question. Yes, assignment is a silver bullet here. If it's an assignment, case over, and the bank wins.
How do you deal with the Third Circuit? Third Circuit cases seem to indicate this isn't just there's a third party involved here.
Well, that's
to trouble the Third Circuit.
Yeah, that's our second silver bullet. That's the recoupment silver bullet. The first silver bullet is assignment. And there's no Third Circuit authority that in any way contravenes our argument there. In fact, we've won this case already in Swartz, in the bankruptcy court in Idaho. And the Swartz court found that because the debtor had parted with everything that he could part with, had assigned to the bank everything that he could assign to the bank, his entire beneficial interest in the tax refund. There's nothing, and this assignment takes place before there's a debt.
Can't assign everything, can he?
He cannot assign bare legal title. That's correct.
Yeah, so the debtor has to retain bare legal title.
The debtor has bare legal title, but that's not enough to make the transfer preferential. I mean, there's not a bare legal title is not something that the estate would benefit from, and so
he also keeps an interest in the anything that's left over, right, in the residuum. If his tax return is larger than the amount of the debt, it goes to him.
The tax return doesn't go to him. What happens is
the
tax return comes to the bank. The bank takes all of the money from the debtor's account into the bank's own funds, and if the bank ends up with a net plus balance, it cuts a check to the debtor. But I wanted to respond to a couple of things that Mr. Nicholson said about the assignment argument, or at least one thing. Mr. Nicholson is correct when he says that we focus on the language in the application, which says that it's an assignment. And the reason we do that is because the application says, notwithstanding any of the other documents in this transaction, this is an assignment. It's written that way for a reason, and the way the other documents read for compliance with the Truth in Lending Act and other provisions doesn't change that. The trustees rely on cases that they say show that this isn't actually an assignment, it's just a security interest. And it's true that there are times when a lender takes an assignment to act as a security interest, to be the backup, to see whether payment gets made. Then if payment's not made, they can execute on the security interest. That's not what happens here at all. Here, there's no expectation that the bank is going to be paid from some other source of funds. The refund isn't really security. The refund is the payment. Everybody expects it's the payment. After the debtor signs the papers, gets his check, he leaves. He doesn't think he's ever going to have to pay anything. He thinks everything's over, she thinks. And they're right. Everything else happens in the train that the debtor has set in motion that day.
Suppose this was the old days and we didn't have all this electronic transfer and the check from the IRS was physically delivered to the debtor, and the debtor was then obliged under the agreement to deliver the, endorse the check to the bank. Any difference in the result?
If it's an assignment, if you recognize the assignment, I don't think there is any difference in the result, because the beneficial ownership of the money is in the bank. Not
the bank would never make a deal like that, would they?
Well, no, they don't. They could. I mean, it's still possible even with the existence of electronic funds transfer, but you don't do it that way. That's exactly right. Let me just briefly address, I can't see the color of the lights, or whether they're on.
They're not on, sir.
Oh, thank you.
We share, the colorblind folks share, have a little problem with that. Yeah, it's not on.
Our second silver bullet is our recoupment argument. And here's how this works, and here's why the whole ordinary course discussion is beside the point. I mean, we think that we've met our burden in ordinary course. We think that the stipulation that the vast majority of these debtors had engaged in identical transactions in prior years is sufficient evidence for the bankruptcy court to have found what it found. There's no clear error. But let me talk about recoupment. And the trustee's claim arises from Section 553B1 of the Bankruptcy Code. And 553B1 allows a trustee to avoid a set-off. And a set-off means where there are mutual obligations, the holder of the money sets it off against the other, against the debt. Now, a set-off is not a transfer. So if this transaction is can be called a set-off, it cannot be called a preferential transfer, and we don't have to worry about ordinary course. It's our position that if this is not an assignment, if for some reason the court finds that this was not a complete assignment of the beneficial title at the time of the loan application, it's still nonetheless a crediting transaction, a 553 transaction. Now, what does the trustee have to show to prevail in 553? He has to show that there were mutual debts and that they were set off against each other. That's what 553 is about. Well, we think there was an assignment, so there aren't mutual debts. But if there are mutual debts, what are those mutual debts? They are the debt of borrower to the bank for the amount that he's borrowed, and there's the debt of the bank to the borrower for the amount in the debtor's account. The next step in the analysis here, the only other step, really, is for questions in addressing whether or not this is a recoupment, you would decide whether the two obligations, borrower to bank, bank to borrower, arise from a single integrated transaction. And here they do. Now, there may be other obligations that other people have had. The debtor has to pay taxes. The government has to refund money that it has. But these aren't the mutual obligations that are being set off. The mutual obligations being set off are debtor, bank, bank, debtor.
Now your colleague says that this really is just a replay of the Third Circuit case substituting the names of the parties.
The Annis case.
Yes.
Well, Annis arises in completely different kinds of facts. In Annis, what happened there, the employees had filed a Chapter 13, and they wanted to take future income as they earned it and pay off a debt to their retirement fund with that income, notwithstanding the plan. Under Chapter 13 law, you cannot make repayments to a plan. That's disposable income, and it needs to be applied to the plan. So the debtors, trying to find some way to put money back in their retirement accounts, really, said, well, wait, how about if we just call this a recoupment? The problem is, you can't call it a recoupment, because at the moment that they want to do a thing, when the employer owes them money, when they want the set-off to occur, the retirement fund doesn't owe them any money. the point at which the debtors wanted to deviate from what the bankruptcy code requires of them in the Chapter 13 sections was they wanted money to come from the employer to the retirement fund. That's a distinct transfer and one that was precluded by the bankruptcy court, so by the bankruptcy code. So when the Third Circuit looked at that, they said, you know, money in the hands of the employer isn't a debt that the retirement fund owes the borrower. So these are distinct. Here, when the recoupment takes place, the money's in the hands of the bank. The borrower has bare legal title, which is, if you look at it as not an assignment, is enough to give rise to a debt, which can then be offset. All right. Let's talk about preferences. Of course, it's only a preference, a preferential transfer, if it's not a crediting transaction and if there wasn't an assignment. And so we have two defenses to the claim that there's a preferential transfer. First, almost in almost every case, the security interest was perfected within 10 days of the making of the loan, and so relates back. Why do I say it was perfected? Well, there was no financing statement was filed that stipulated, but so the bank was not perfected in the tax refund when it was in the hands of when the money was in the hands of the IRS. But when the IRS sends the funds transfer to the bank gets possession. It doesn't have bare legal title yet. It has possession. And that perfects because it's money. And it's electrons. It's not paper with printed ink, there are electrons that have been issued by the government for the purpose of being used as legal tender. They're as much money as anything else. Our other defense is that these repayments, that the transfer is made in the ordinary course of the debtors and the bank's business. The only real argument here, as Mr. Nicholson says, on that defense is whether or not the debts were incurred in the debtor's ordinary course, the ordinary course of the debtor's affairs. Now they want to look at the terms of the loans and all of that, but that's not the right analysis. And you don't compare the terms of a RAL loan or the terms of a car loan with the terms of a mortgage. You look within the industry and decide what makes sense. Almost all of these debtors, 85% of them, had gotten identical transactions the year before that, or the year before that, or some many of those years. This is ordinary for them. Your tax refund, your tax return obligation only comes around once a year, so it's not something that you can do more often than once a year. Many of these have done it once a year, and it happens in the same way. You assign your refund, and these debtors were doing this ordinarily. Now, what about the first-timers? Well, a first-time transaction can be ordinary, because there has to be a first time for every ordinary thing. What the bankruptcy court did, what the court in the Valley Steel case did, if you look at the terms of the, you look at what happened and you look to see whether this is the sort of thing that consumers ordinarily do. And the record's sufficient for that. There's 100 people that engaged in an identical transaction, many of them over the years. That's not clear error in our view. There aren't any questions, though.
I guess when you all is said and done, and you close the briefs and you sit back and you think about it, though, you wonder if you're not really asking us to come up with what judges sometimes call an H2SO4 result. You know what? You can fit it into an equation, but the result smells bad. I mean, basically, in the end, what you're asking us to do here is to approve of a which amounts to a scheme by which a somebody on the financial ropes can insulate a certain amount of money from his creditors that he couldn't otherwise do. And that's basically what happens here, doesn't it, when it's all said and done?
Well, first, and this goes to a point raised earlier, the debtors certify in the application that they do not anticipate filing for bankruptcy. So this isn't a jockeying for advantage in the bankruptcy. Your Honor's correct if you say that this is a well-protected loan. It's a loan that's made without a credit check, without any particular extensive research on the part of the lender, to basically all comers. Mm-hmm. But in return for being a loan to all comers, it's well protected.
There's certainly a policy in the bankruptcy code to encourage certain lenders to continue to lend money to people in dire financial straits. But that doesn't seem like this transaction. You're not trying to keep somebody at least minimally operating to see if, in fact, they can make it or if there's any possibility of resuscitating them. You're really giving somebody a very absolute discretion cushion here.
Well, we don't know what they're doing with the money, and it may be that people have credit card bills that come due. I think the other point, if I may just finish the thought, is the trustees here aren't about protecting the debtor. I mean, that isn't what it's about. It's mm-hmm. about getting money to pay credit card debt or whatever other debts these borrowers have. This isn't about consumer protection at all.
I just have one quick question. In terms of the percentage, do you know what the proportion is of people who go into bankruptcy that avail themselves of this situation that the bank has set up? The percentage, you know, that wasn't in the record, was it?
It isn't in the record. There's an extra record document that was submitted by the other side, which claims that there were several million rows made by my client. I think the number may be off, but the magnitude is right. There are millions, and we're here on a 100. I don't think it's particularly high. If you look at the reported cases, and I deal with these all the time, and it's not that frequent. I don't believe it's a high percentage at all. So, my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. You have 5 minutes, sir.
Picking up where I think that just ended, you know, one of the primary policies of preference law is to discourage unusual action by either the debtor or the creditor as the debtor's on its slide in the bankruptcy. And that gets into the ordinary court. You know, did any of the debtors engage in other short-term high-cost loans? We don't know. There's nothing in the record. Would the debtor's other creditors, would they be surprised to know that the bank's loan got paid in full when they're just getting their minimum payment? What did the debtors do with that money? We don't know. Those are all questions that I think go to whether this was in the ordinary course of business for that particular debtor.
And you don't think you can just look at the activity of the debtor, the repeat customers, and determine that that was ordinary course? Why did they have to engage in other loans or involved in other loans to establish ordinary course? And do you have any authority that suggests that they need more?
I do. The Armstrong case, mm-hmm. the Armstrong case from the Eighth Circuit, which is similar in many respects. That case involved a debtor, happened to be a lawyer, who went to Harrah's Casino, lost a lot of money, and issued markers, you know, which are very short-term loans from a casino. And those were paid, and he did that regularly, or, you know, had done that several times. And in that case, the court found, well, the casino proved that issuing those markers wasn't the normal course of the casino's business. But there was nothing to show that getting these kinds of loans to use the proceeds in that manner was in the ordinary course of business for that debtor. I mean, he was a lawyer, happened to be, and he was, he was trying to gamble to get some money.
But isn't that a different circumstance here? Because we have many individuals who use this process, many debtors who do it, who are repeat customers.
I don't think that the analysis under 523C is that we look at society in general and say, well, because these guys give millions of these loans, then it's in the ordinary course of business. I think we have to look at the regular consumer. And it may well be that for some of these people, it was in the ordinary course of their business. Maybe they did go and get these payday loans regularly or something like this. But maybe what they did was get that loan, real quickly and go down to Bermuda for a week and then come back and file bankruptcy. I mean, heck, some of these people filed bankruptcy before the 10 or 12 days before the electronic transfer hit their account. What'd they do with that money? I think there's a lack of proof. I believe that the statute requires that you look at both the debtor and as well as the bank, and certainly the bank it's stipulated. I think one of the cases that the bank relies on for the proposition that a first time transaction is conducted in accordance with the terms of the agreement can be ordinary is this Finn case from the Sixth Circuit. And that case also involves consumer debt. And interestingly, in that case, both the bankruptcy and the district court ruled that the consumer debt was never in the ordinary course of business for the debtors. Now, the Sixth Circuit reversed that. But what they stated, they said that the ordinary course analysis is peculiarly factual. In that particular case, they remanded it. They also said, as a general rule, subject to the individual fact-finding powers, first-time transactions can be in the ordinary course of business. But then they added a caveat. This rule holds when the transaction would not be out of the ordinary for a person in the borrower's position. We don't know anything about these debtors, and I think that's the point. I'd like to hit this issue of recoupment here real quickly. I think that both the bankruptcy and the district court just were fundamentally flawed in their analysis of recoupment. I mean, at its core, recoupment is an adjustment of the liability between the parties. There was no adjustment here. The quintessential example is the overpayment in the Medicaid case, and then they come back and they say, well, I'm going to short you on your next payment. And that's not what happened here. The debt, everyone knew what the debt was. When that transfer went in there, that was payment, and the payment did not perfect a security interest. It was payment. It was that security interest was never perfected.
Thank you, Mr. Nicholson. The court would like to thank both Mr. Nicholson and Mr. Carpenter for their fine presentations today in a very difficult case. And the case will be taken under advisement.